Thank you, sir. 95.
We're ready to proceed on the first case.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas M. Farrell will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case is about whether the court should be in the business of second-guessing choices that corporate parties have made as to how to structure their transactions, and about whether parties can have certainty and finality in the transactions that they structure. In this case, the Court of Appeals has reached out to try and create a fact question, and as a result, a transaction that was valued at over $600 million that the parties thought closed over 4.5 years ago is still open and is still uncertain, and the parties have not been able to achieve the finality in that transaction that corporate law really demands. The Court of Appeals in this case found a fact question because it determined that there was an issue about whether the transaction that was structured as a stock sale, that the parties concede was structured as a stock sale, was really an asset sale disguised as a stock sale. The court apparently reached that conclusion solely because the stock purchase agreement was not part of the summary judgment record. The petitioners would submit that the whole concept of an asset sale or stock sale really being a disguised asset sale is a non sequitur. It's nonsensical. The law of this state, the corporate law of this state, and virtually every other state, allows the parties to make choices and alternatives in how they structure their transactions. There is a perfectly legitimate way to structure a transaction, sell the assets or all the assets of a company. Another perfectly legitimate way to structure a transaction is for the purchaser to purchase the stock of a company. In this case, the parties made a choice between those two alternatives. The stock of Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids Corporation was sold to an Enron entity, and that's what happened here. There is no way that that kind of transaction can, in fact, be disguised. It cannot, as a matter of law, as a matter of logic, be really an asset sale. When the stock of a company is sold, the shares of that company, the certificates, are transferred. The new owner of the stock is reflected on the corporate books and records.
What if it were an admitted subterfuge?
It's difficult to imagine, Your Honor, how there could be a subterfuge in this kind of context, because either the shares of the company are sold, the stock certificates are sold, or the assets are sold.
No, but I mean, what if the parties got together and said, look, we know we can't do it this way, but we're going to have to do it this other way because we really do want to do something to get out of our agreement?
Well, if there was a actual fraud in the sense that the parties really were conveying assets and dummied up a fake stock certificate, that would be one scenario.
But short of that, no matter what their intent was, if that was the form of the transaction, it's okay.
Absolutely. The intent of the parties here is irrelevant. And the reason it's irrelevant is because all parties know when they enter into these kind of restrictions on the alienability of assets, when they're dealing with a corporate party, that the stock of that corporate party can change. That's a fundamental fact that all parties recognize when they enter into one of these transactions. And it's for that reason that parties sometimes negotiate what's called change in control provisions, those being provisions that trigger a right of first refusal or some other restriction on transfer when there is a change of ownership or change of control in the company that owns the asset. Those are common restrictions that are sometimes negotiated by the parties. In this case, we have...
But a change of control in the owner of the corporation really contemplates that stock ownership in the holding corporation somehow changes. It's not, I mean, isn't that what it goes to? It doesn't go that the corporation itself gets sold to some other corporation.
Well, different provisions, Your Honor, can be negotiated differently. Sometimes change in control provisions are negotiated where if there's a change of a certain percentage in ownership of the company that owns the asset, then the right is triggered. Sometimes they're drafted so that it's only if there's 100% change in control where the trigger would occur. In this circumstance, the parties were free to have negotiated any one of those various alternatives, but the record is absolutely clear that they did not. And the right of first refusal that they negotiated is limited solely to the asset.
your answer would be the same if the sole asset of the corporation was this enterprise. If the sole asset of this corporation is this enterprise, your answer would be the same, that the owner of the shares of that corporation asset is freely transferable to anybody at any time, regardless of the first right of refusal to buy the asset.
Absent a specific provision negotiated by the parties that would restrict the sale of the stock, I think that's correct. Of course, that's not the situation here. This corporation, TNGL, or Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids Corporation, owned an entire natural gas liquids business and owned many other assets other than the interest in this fractionator. But yes, if the parties have not negotiated a restriction on the alienability of stock, then none can be implied. And that's been the law of the state and the policy of this state for a long time. The Earthman's case, which we cited in our briefs, makes clear that there's really no such thing as an implied restriction on the alienability of stock. The policy of this state is that stock should be freely alienable, and that if the parties want to restrict the transfer of that stock, then they need to negotiate it. And if they do negotiate a restriction on the transfer of stock, that restriction needs to be strictly construed because it's against the policy of this state. The same issue really came up, the issue of whether a court can be in the business of recharacterizing the transaction that the parties have done in the context of the de facto merger doctrine, which a number of years ago some courts of appeals had written that what is really a sale of assets, where it's substantially all of the assets of a company, can be recharacterized by a court after the fact to impose liability on the purchasing company under the de facto merger doctrine. In other words, a court can recharacterize what is really an asset sale as a merger. And in the next legislative session, after those courts of appeals opinions came out, the legislature emphatically said no, that the courts should not be in the business of recharacterizing the party's transactions. That if somebody wants to restrict, if a party wants to restrict certain kinds of transactions, they need to negotiate for those restrictions. And in this case, that simply did not occur. The Court of Appeals struggled here to create a fact question. Even if you assume for a moment that it is possible in some circumstances for a court, after the fact, to recharacterize a transaction, the three grounds that the Court of Appeals relied on here simply don't even come close to raising any kind of a fact question on the nature of the transaction. The Court of Appeals said, first, that a press release that was issued that Court of Appeals construed as describing this transaction as an asset transaction could somehow change the fundamental nature of the transaction. The problem is that was a press release that was issued by the ultimate parent of these companies, Tenneco Inc., and it did describe the sale of assets, the asset being the stock of Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids Company. As to that entity that issued the press release, this was an asset sale, i.e., the stock of the company was sold. But it is undisputed in this record that what Enron bought was the stock of Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids Corporation, and there is no restriction on that kind of a transaction anywhere in the agreements. The other thing that the Court of Appeals relied on was the fact that the parties elected under the Internal Revenue Code to treat this transaction for tax purposes as an asset sale. That is totally irrelevant to the issue of state law and the interpretation of the parties' agreements here. The Internal Revenue Code has said that the parties can elect a fiction for purposes of income tax treatment and can have taxed as an asset sale something that is in fact a stock sale. The fact that option was available to the parties simply proves that this was, under state law, truly a stock transaction. The other fact that the Court of Appeals, which is not disputed, relied on to create a fact question on the nature of this transaction is the fact that originally Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids Corporation contemplated selling its assets as opposed to its stock. That, again, is totally irrelevant to the ultimate question of how was the transaction finally structured. The fact that they considered one alternative at the beginning and then changed to another alternative proves absolutely nothing when the parties' agreements gave them the right to sell the stock of the company without triggering one of these restrictions. And that really points up what to me is the ultimate irony of this case. Parties in the Court of Appeals have spent a lot of time considering this issue of stock sale versus asset sale, but ultimately in this case, that's an irrelevant issue totally, because There is a specific exception to the right of first refusal in Article 12.6 of the relevant agreement that says...
What about their argument that you didn't raise that as a ground in your motion in the trial court?
Your Honor, I think we did raise the exception of 12.6 in the summary judgment papers. It was not extensively discussed in the summary judgment papers, but the fact
that... You didn't meet the transcript side on that?
Your Honor, I'll have to get that for you. I believe it was discussed in Enron's motion for summary judgment, which was then picked up in Penico's first motion for summary judgment. And that provision of the restated operating agreement says that in any event, even if you are dealing with an asset sale, if it is a sale of all or substantially all of the assets of the company, the right of first refusal is not triggered anyway. And clearly the parties here contemplated that there would be corporate reorganizations, that there might ultimately be a new entity that owned this fractionator interest without triggering a right of first refusal, either through a sale of all or substantially all of the assets or through a stock sale. They could have expressly provided against those kind of transactions, but they simply did not. The issue in this case of the need to put the stock purchase agreement into evidence, which the Court of Appeals appeared to rely on so heavily, is again a total red herring. First of all, there was absolutely no objection to the lack of the stock purchase agreement made at the time the summary judgment was granted in the trial court. And more importantly, the very summary judgment evidence offered by respondents in opposition to the summary judgment establishes itself that this was a stock sale. Respondents put into the summary judgment record deposition testimony. They put in corporate records consisting of the minute portions of the minute books of Tenneco Natural Gas Assets that reflect unequivocally that this was, in fact, a stock sale.
Counsel, can I get you to address why the first transfer was effective under 12.2 of the contract?
Certainly, Your Honor. 12.2 provides that a transferee must assume a delivery obligation different than the transferor, but on its face, it applies only to transfers that are authorized by Section 12.1. Section 12.1 is a provision that on its face authorizes transfers either to other owners or to third parties.
All right. In 12.6, who drafted this contract?
You know, I'm not sure that it's in the record who drafted it. It was a drafted by both parties with extensive negotiation.
Well, at any rate, in 12.6, the drafters of the contract were able to segregate out affiliates. And they weren't segregated out in either 12.2 or 12.1. So one interpretation of this contract would be that they are not to be excluded.
Except that I would respond by saying that 12.2 is the specific provision that supposedly creates this new delivery obligation. On its face, it only applies unambiguously to transactions that are authorized by 12.1, and 12.1 is not the authorizing provision for affiliate transfers. If the parties had wanted to restrict or impose this new delivery obligation on an affiliate, they would have expressly provided for that. And we submitted substantial summary judgment evidence from the parties, sworn deposition testimony from each of the other owners, that is in fact how they interpreted the agreement, not just with respect to the TNGL transaction, but other affiliate transactions among the owner group. There was never any attempt to enforce Section 12.2 as it relates to affiliate transfers. And there were several other examples of affiliate transfers other than the Tenneco transfer.
Okay, well, the use of the language third party is not included in either 12.5 or 12.6, is it?
That's correct, not in 12.5 or 12.6.
Why would third party not include an affiliate?
It could, but if you go back to other provisions of the agreement where the parties specifically spelled out obligations, I think it's 5.1, Section 5.1 and Section 5.2, where they deal with affiliates as one group of entities, owners as another group of entities, and third parties as a separate group of entities. And when they got to Section 12.2, They selected two of those three groups of entities to deal with, owners and third parties, but made no reference to affiliates. Had they wanted to restrict or impose a greater delivery obligation on affiliates, I think under an unambiguous interpretation of the agreement, they would have had to have specifically spelled out affiliates in Section 12.1.
What about the argument of the other side that there is a fact issue concerning waiver?
Your Honor, in this case, there was express waiver. The other side and the Court of Appeals relied on the fact, which I don't think is supported by the record, but the fact that there was supposedly no evidence of reliance or prejudice shown, so therefore there can be no waiver. There is no requirement under the waiver cases to show prejudice or reliance when there is an express waiver. In this case, there was a document from Enterprise, who was authorized on behalf of all of the owners to deal with these transfer issues, that expressly acknowledged, in Enterprise's words, the TOC to TNGL transaction. That is an express waiver. Given the express waiver, there's no requirement that there be any kind of reliance or prejudice. And having expressly acknowledged a transaction, when the contract, the only thing the contract gave them the right to do was to deny the effectiveness of the transaction, as a matter of law, we think that there is a waiver. When you follow that with the notion that the parties thereafter, and this is all undisputed in the record, amended the restated operating agreement, entered into several other agreements among themselves that expressly reflected that TNGL, the transferee, not Tenneco Oil Company, the transferor, was the owner and was the partner of Mont Belvieu Associates, it's just inconceivable that there can still remain a fact question under an express waiver analysis. There's also reams of summary judgment evidence of an implied waiver in the sense that all of these parties knew that the transaction had taken place. It's undisputed that they knew that TNGL was not delivering the 31,000 barrels a day that they now say was required and had not entered into a new fractionation agreement. And they allowed that state of affairs to continue for 3 years. In those circumstances, we think, as a matter of law, that waiver was established.
Any other questions? Hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Murray Vogler will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, let's talk about sanctity of contract. The petitioners ask, why shouldn't the Tenecos and the Enrons of this world be free to structure their transaction however they wish? And the answer, of course, is generally they should be. But when one of the parties, in this case, Tenneco, was already a party to a pre-existing contract that set restrictions on how that party could enter into future transactions. The first contract is also entitled to be enforced and is also entitled to its own sanctity. That first contract, of course, is this 1985 restated operating agreement, the one that set restrictions on transfers of ownership interest in this fractionation plant. Tenneco, as one of the parties to that agreement, agreed that it would abide by the restrictions in the agreement on transfers of ownership interest. Now, I want you to consider why it is that joint owners of an individual asset have rights of first refusal or restrictions in their agreement on transfers, sometimes called preferential rights to purchase. That's what the parties here called it, or preemptive rights. Why do they do that? Because they want to make sure they know who they're doing business with, and they want to give each other the right to acquire additional interest if they want to. That was extremely important to the parties in this case because this fractionation plant, all it does is take natural gas liquids and separate them. And the owners of the plant in 1985, when they made this agreement, were also suppliers to the plant of the natural gas liquids, of the raw make. And everybody who was a party to the agreement had an incentive to keep the plant at full capacity, to make it profitable.
Counsel, those arguments aside, isn't it true that the only reason the Court of Appeals overturned the summary judgment, at least with regard to the second transfer, is because the agreement was not attached?
That is indeed correct.
And isn't it true that you all had a copy of the agreement?
Oh, yes. There's no question about that.
And it's true that you didn't offer it in the summary judgment evidence.
That is also correct. Of course, it wasn't my burden as the respondent to the summary judgment motions to make the summary judgment record. But I'm not asking this court, and I don't think this court here ought to decide the case on some procedural technicality. I don't think you granted the writ on those issues. I would think that there's some reason to determine the issue that the petitioners have argued about. Is the Fifth Circuit correct in their West Texas Transmission case that the owner of a preemptive right shouldn't have that right taken away by specifically designing a transaction around that right?
Counsel said you could have contracted to prevent this outcome. What's your response to that?
Well, my first response, and this is something that was not treated by the Court of Appeals, in fact, in the opinion, they specifically declined to rule on this point. The very argument that was made in the trial court to begin with was that the contract itself, the restated operating agreement, doesn't talk about asset sales or stock sales. The language of the restated operating agreement is extremely broad. It says, an owner shall have the right to sell, transfer, assign, or otherwise convey all or any portion of its ownership interest, either in favor of another owner or a third party. And my point is that, in my view, my reading of this contract, doesn't matter whether it's a stock sale or an asset sale, it's a transfer. It's a transfer. There wouldn't be two parties sitting at this table if there weren't a transfer. There wouldn't be the argument from the Tenneco defendants, we're not involved in the next transaction because it's the same party. Because the fact that the realities of the corporate world here is there are different parties that now own this interest than before.
Well, going back to your broad brush point of view, how is this transfer when there is a stock sale? Because the rights to individual property owned by corporations are not transferred when there's a stock sale. There's merely a change in ownership.
Well, let's, if I can, I'm going to answer your question, but let's go back to what happened in the case here and what's in the summary judgment record. Because in the fall of 1991, when Tenneco offered these assets for sale, they offered them as packages of assets, including their interest in this fractionator. And in fact, in the offering materials, they acknowledged that the other owners of the plant had a right of first refusal. Then in November of 1991, Enron makes its offer to buy those assets. Now, under the agreement, this is my reading of the agreement in 12.5, once there has been a bona fide offer made, and there was even a form contract that's part of the summary judgment evidence that Enron marked up and submitted back on the acquisition of this asset. And at that point in time, there was a contractual duty on the part of Tenneco to offer, to make that same offer that Enron had made to the other owners. Furthermore, there wasn't just a contractual duty, because one of the unique aspects of this case is that Tenneco owned its interest in the plant together with Enterprise in a partnership. I submit they had a fiduciary obligation to think about the interest of their partner at a time when they got an interest, an offer, a firm offer to buy their interest in the plant, and they had decided to sell their interest in the plant as an asset.
Could you paraphrase the fact issue that you think the jury ought to decide?
I think the jury ought to decide the very issue that the Fifth Circuit set out, and that is, did Tenneco and Enron specifically design their transaction so as to circumvent the preemptive right.
What difference does that make?
What difference does it make?
What if they all got together and said, now, we're not going to do this just to circumvent this right. We're going to do this for all these other reasons, but we're still going to do it. Then you lose?
That's right. If the jury believes that their transaction had other commercially reasonable reasons to restructure the way they did, if the jury believes that they acted in good faith, and they can prove that in a trial, not in a summary judgment, then yes, we lose at that point.
Looks to me like they're going to always say they had good intentions.
Well, of course they are. Of course they are.
Well, so why are we going to braid this into a jury? Do you believe these lying, no good people or not?
Well,
when the sale is structured the way it was.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, juries decide those very types of issues all the time. I mean, we're not talking about revolutionary principles here. We're talking about good faith, bad faith, commercial reasonableness. We have summary judgment evidence in the record that one of the reasons why they restructured the deal was so as to avoid dealing with the right of first refusal. That's in the record. Now, maybe they had other reasons. Maybe it made business sense. Maybe it made tax sense. Maybe they thought it was easier. But they sure were in a hurry to get it done by the end of the year, and it was quicker to do it that way. And if the jury believes those are all good enough reasons so that they can get around this right, if indeed that works, we lose.
But this is not a tricky format that they just thought up for this transaction. People do this all the time. Coming back to the question Judge Cornyn asked, why wasn't this contracted for? You certainly could contract for it.
Well, and as I said, my first argument is I think they did contract for it. I think that this agreement is broad enough to cover stock sales, asset sales, any kind of transfer. I mean, what happened here, Your Honor, I don't think the parties really anticipated a situation where as Mr. Farrell says, an integrated supplier of natural gas liquids like Tenneco Oil Company was going to take their interest, put it in a smaller company, and then by the time they offered this for sale in 1991, we're talking about just a company that owned two assets, a pipeline and the interest in the plant. It didn't own any more production of natural gas or natural gas liquids, didn't own any other assets. That was it. That was not within the contemplation at the time. So when you talk about this 12.6, for example, sale of all of the company, well, is it proper to take your whole company and carve it up so that now you've got a little company and you can say, now I'm selling all the assets of the company? Well, it seems to me a jury can determine, based on what the motives were they just doing all of these corporate transactions in order to avoid what they contracted for back in 1985, which is we're going to give the other owners a chance to buy it on the, that's all it is, just a chance to buy it on the same terms as somebody else like Enron. If we ever decide to sell, we're going to give the other parties the same right. And that's the only thing. And these, as I said, I mean, the Fifth Circuit opinion, I think it sets out some pretty good standards. The First Court of Appeals in the Texas State Optical versus Wiggins case followed that and sent a case back to be tried on the same kinds of issues. And as I said, these types of fact-intensive issues are the very types that juries deal with all of the time.
I assume your client sees some value and certainty in their commercial relationships.
Absolutely.
And the prospect of a jury trial is, some might argue, is the antithesis of certainty.
Yes, I can understand that argument. And, I mean, believe me, I mean, my clients in this case are sophisticated businesses as well that deal with these types of transactions all the time. I think this whole thing could have been avoided. You wouldn't have this dispute or this potential for a jury trial if Tenneco had simply offered the asset to its joint owners back in 1991. There wouldn't be any breach of the agreement. There wouldn't be any dispute. They would still end up with the same amount of money, obviously, as they were going to end up at the time of the transaction with Enbar. That's all we're asking for. All they had to do was comply with what they had agreed to. If they want certainty, why isn't it more certain to follow what they agreed to back in 1985 instead of trying to get around what they agreed to? That's, it seems to me that this is the kind of thing, again, clever lawyers, clever corporate lawyers, are going to find ways to try to structure agreements all of the time, and clever litigation lawyers are going to try to find ways to attack it.
Mr. Fogler, but under your scenario, if I've got a large company and I want to take a number of assets that are related and spin them off into a separate affiliate, would that buy me a lawsuit as to each individual asset that might have a first right of refusal applying to it?
Well, it might if you haven't offered that to the other owners of each of the assets, if they have the right of first refusal.
So if I have an asset or two that are similarly related in my enterprise that are subject to that, then I would effectively be stopped from doing any sort of reorganization stock-wise, because I would always be subject to each individual piece of asset being sold off just by my attempt to restructure.
If you had agreed in the first place to restrictions on transfers that were broad enough to cover those kinds of transactions, then yes. I mean,
just the agreement would be simply an agreement like we have here, where it's just if you sell the asset, you've got to offer it to your partners first.
I say that that agreement freely made, like this one was in 1985, ought to be enforced. The whole purpose here, as I said, is the joint owners of this particular asset put this right in there for a reason. And in fact, what happened with the three transfers here from Tenneco Oil to Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids to Enron to whatever the partnership name is now, the very thing that we contracted to prevent has happened, which is now we have an owner of the plant that has not been willing to commit to bring any raw make, doesn't have a supply of raw make to bring, and we're in the position that we sought not to be in. That's the whole very purpose for it. And that's the reason why we filed a lawsuit in the first place.
If I understand your argument, you keep coming back to a claim that instead of this being a stock transfer, which is the way they wanted to characterize it, it really was an asset transfer.
Your Honor, we argued that
either a
point.
Stock or an asset transfer. Whatever kind of transfer is it?
Your Honor, there's no question that it was a stock transfer. Okay? I'm saying that what they did, though, originally it was an asset transfer. There's no question about that either. I'm saying that based on the Fifth Circuit case, West Texas Transmission, based on this First Court of Appeals case, that once they decide to transfer their ownership and they get a bona fide offer to do so, that's what triggers the obligation on their part to make that same offer to their joint owners.
Okay, but there are provisions in the contract that you participated in that says that if it is an out-and-out asset transfer, and if it's substantially all the assets, then that is excluded from the right of first refusal.
That's true, too. But again, as I said, the way they have structured this transaction, by the time Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids, the stock of that company, was sold, there was only one or two assets left in that company. Was it fair for them to structure the deal that way? That's for the jury to decide. I mean, I understand that there are not only restrictions on transfers, but exceptions to it, and I think the agreement ought to be applied as written.
Would you address the first transfer and tell me why you think there is evidence showing that there was neither express nor implied waiver?
The first transfer in 1989 from Tenneco Oil to Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids clearly was an affiliate transfer. The only section of the contract that deals with transfers at all is 12.1. The only section of the contract that deals with the delivery obligation as to transferees is 12.2. As you noted, and as the Court of Appeals noted in its opinion on this very point, if the parties who knew how to write exceptions for affiliate transfers, as they did on the preferential rights section, had intended there to be an exception under 12.2 as to affiliates, they could have written one in, and they did not. That section plainly applies, in my view and in the Court of Appeals' view, to all transfers and transfers to affiliates. Now, what happened here? Now, clearly, the summary judgment record shows that the other owners recognized that Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids was a joint owner. As the Court of Appeals said, and I agree with their analysis completely on this point, we had a choice at that point. This is not an exclusive remedy under 12.2. We didn't have to say, we're not going to recognize the effectiveness of your transfer. We could accept them as an owner and enforce the consequences of their breach of the agreement if they failed to deliver the sufficient quantities of the raw make to the plant, and that's what we did. There is no summary judgment evidence that we ever gave up that right. Now, we certainly said in our writings and in our statements to them, yes, we recognize you're an owner of this plant. But we never said to them, we also are waiving our right to call upon you to deliver what you're supposed to. There is no summary judgment evidence as to that. I would can simply conclude there are a number of procedural issues that were raised by the Enron petitioners in their brief that were discussed in the Court of Appeals. I have to confess, if I were going to do all of this over again in the trial court, I probably would have handled some things differently in the way the record was done. But as I said, I presume that the writ was granted in this case to deal with the important issue, one that I think is important, about preemptive rights. And in this case, we're presented with a summary judgment case, one where there is sufficient evidence in the record to demonstrate that there would be commercially unreasonable standards here and how these parties structure their transaction. This case ought to go back for trial.
Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Please, the Court. Justice Baker, in answer to your question earlier, the transcript references are page 337, which is the Tenneco motion for summary judgment, and page 41, which is the Enron motion for summary judgment, is where the 12.6 issue was raised in support of summary judgment.
Mr. Pryor, would you address the argument of counsel that you're bound by the first contract, the 1985 contract, and you're trying to get around it?
Justice Gonzales, we fully concede we're bound by the 1985 contract. What that contract provides is that if there is a transfer of ownership interest, and it's not in connection with the sale of all or substantially all of the assets, then there is a right of first refusal. Ownership interest is a defined term in the contract. It is defined as the party's percentage interest in the, quote, facilities. Facilities is defined as the physical assets, the fractionation plant itself, and the real estate on which it exists. Clearly, the 85 contract only burdens a transfer of that asset. We complied fully with that. When it was contemplated originally that there might be a sale of assets, we recognized that if there were, and if it was not substantially all of the assets, that right would be triggered. That's not the transaction that was ultimately done. Counsel says that when Enron submitted an offer for all of the assets, that somehow at that point the right of first refusal was triggered and we had an obligation to extend it at that point. The problem with that is that Article 12.5, which is the right of first refusal, says that it's only triggered when the parties have executed a contract. The transferor and the transferee have executed a contract. At that point, that's when, if the right is going to be triggered, it is triggered. In this case, there was never a contract executed for the sale of assets. The only contract that was ever executed was for the sale of stock, and that's simply not covered by Section 12.5 of the Restated Operating Agreement. Council makes reference to the Fifth Circuit's opinion in West Texas Transmission as imposing some kind of good faith duty in these circumstances. That case is totally inapplicable. It deals with a situation where the right of first refusal was clearly triggered. Nobody was arguing in the West Texas Transmission case about whether it was an asset sale or a stock sale. All parties conceded that the right of first refusal was triggered. The issue in that case was whether the offer that had been received from a third party was a, quote, bona fide offer. The contract required that it be a bona fide offer. The argument was whether certain conditions had been imposed in the offer that were not bona fide and therefore were designed to defeat the right of first refusal. That's a totally different issue. It was decided as purely as a matter of traditional contract principles and interpretation of the term bona fide offer. In this case, we never get to the point of whether there was a bona fide offer because we don't have a transaction that triggered the right of first refusal under the clear and unambiguous terms of Section 12.5. Council also suggests that there had been some impropriety going on because in 1991, at the time of the stock sale, Tenneco Natural Gas Liquids was down to one or two assets and was no longer the substantial company that had originally entered into the agreements in 1985. I submit that the summary judgment evidence is directly contrary to that. Five asset packages were considered for sale in 1991, asset packages worth some $600 million. It was the entire natural gas liquids business of the Tenneco entities consisted of, in addition to this fractionation plant, dozens of other assets worth some $600 million. Clearly, it was not a case where they had stripped out this fractionator and stuck it in a corporate shell and then sold the stock of the corporate shell.
But even if they had, you said it wouldn't make any difference?
I think even if they had, it would not, because parties, when you deal in a corporate context, clearly understand that your contracting party might change control, might change ownership, and if you desire to restrict that kind of activity, you simply must negotiate for it specifically. Finally, council said that the parties here wanted to make sure that they knew who they were doing business with, and that's the reason for the right of first refusal in the first place. By submitting Section 12.6, they allowed for the very thing that happened to happen here.
Thank you, council.
Thank you.
This concludes the argument in this case, so we'll take a short recess.
All rise.